Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the TetraCast, episode 364, recording on September 14, 2024. I am your substitute host, Josh Torres. Your usual host, Brian, is out of town for right now, enjoying his life on a cruise, I believe, at the moment. So he'll be out this week and next week, I believe. A well-earned break, well-earned rest. In the meantime, I'm here. And joining me are the usual ones, Adam Vitali.
Hello.
Chao Min Wu.
How's it going?
And James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
So this has been an interesting week for RPGs, where we got the final part of the expansion pass of Persona 3 Reload with the release of Episode Aegis, which is the remake answer from Persona 3 Fest. And then we also have the PC and mobile release of Dragon Quest Monsters, The Dark Prince, which recently came out last year on the Switch exclusively. Now that's out of the Switch exclusivity. And Adam got a chance to go hands-on with the PC version of Dragon Quest Monsters, The Dark Prince. Tell us about it, Adam.
Yeah, so Square Enix has a couple of releases coming out this month with the PC port of this. The PC report of Final Fantasy 16 is just next week. Or is it next week? Yeah.
I think it is.
In less than a week. So I have played every mainline Dragon Quest game, at least a version of every mainline Dragon Quest game. And I played a few of the spin-offs. Like I played Dragon Quest Treasures last year for when that came out on PC. Kind of, that was a shadow drop, right? Just out now, last year, for Dragon Quest Treasures.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so this Dragon Quest... Anyways, I have not played a Dragon Quest Monsters game. I have played other monster-raising RPGs, so I kind of figure it's in that vein, but I've never played Dragon Quest Monsters specifically. I know it had a couple of entries on, like, the Game Boy, DS, 3DS, and this is the latest one, Dragon Quest The Dark Prince. Came out on Twitch last year, like you said. It's Dragon Quest Monsters 3 in Japan. They just dropped the 3 in the West. Cullen, I believe, reviewed this last year for us on the Switch. And when he was approaching this game, when he reviewed it on Switch, he's a big Dragon Quest IV fan, which this game kind of takes Dragon Quest IV as like its base in terms of its flavor, in terms of its style. It features Saro, who is, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, Saro, who is and the antagonist of Dragon Quest IV, but now he's the protagonist of this sort of monster spinoff. And I specifically remember Cullen's main criticism of this game, Dragon Quest Monsters 3, was that the story stuff is just kind of there. It's not really... He kind of went into this game as a, oh, I'm a huge Dragon Quest IV fan. I need to play all the Dragon Quest IV content there is, and here's a new spinoff of Dragon Quest IV. But I think he realized that that's probably not the best way to approach this game. I would think of it more like a Dragon Quest Monsters game in a Dragon Quest IV coat of paint versus like a Dragon Quest IV spinoff that's a Monsters game, if that makes sense.
So yeah.
It's more just like the dressing of the game, like just the aesthetic. I haven't finished it yet because it just came out earlier, a couple days ago, really. And I did not have early access or anything like that. I'm about 10-15 hours in, and I think I have a pretty good idea of the loop of the game, the structure of the game, the design of the game. And yeah, the story is not the reason to play this.
I think it's really weird how it first like presents the game, because like with the lead up to like before the gameplay loop is very awkwardly structured in segments that like if you don't have like a back at least a familiarity with Dragon Quest IV, it'll feel kind of weird. That's what I remember.
Have you played it?
I played a little bit of it on Switch, but I didn't finish it.
Yeah. So the I actually sort of chuckled at how this game opens. It goes like 100 miles a minute. It's like, you're Saro. You're the half monster son of a monster king guy. Like, oh, your mother is sick. You got to go save your mother. Oh, you are in town with these children, and the children is under attack by a monster. You fight off the monster. Then they realize you're also a monster. Then they kick you out. And now you're traveling the world, and now you're in another town, being adopted by this other family friendly town, and your mother is dead now. By the way, time to go get some monsters. And this all happens within like 20 minutes.
Like, whoa, yeah, geez, this sounds like a run-on sentence.
it's what it feels like.
Yeah.
I don't really mind it too much. I kind of figure this game being like a monster raising game is kind of just, it's almost just like getting the premise out of the way as soon as it possibly can.
Yeah.
Like, all right, here are the characters. Here's what you're doing. Here's why you're collecting monsters. Go, 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 go. And all right, now we're in the game. Now we can kind of settle in to the actual monster raising, collecting part of the game. So again, I have not played Dragon Quest Monsters, like any other version of it. I haven't played Joker. I don't know. I know there's different versions of the earlier games. I don't know anything. In this game, how it works, just very briefly, is you basically run into monsters on the field, and it's kind of got like a Pokemon-like mechanic where you can weaken them, and then you can basically, rather than throwing a Pokeball, you show like a display of power. I forget how they phrase it. It's like you literally show like how strong you are, and you fill up a meter depending on how strong you are and how weak they are. And if that meter, the higher that meter fills up, the higher the chances that the monster will join you. And then you once you recruit these monsters, you set up a team of four. So it's like a party of four, which is similar to most Dragon Quest or some Dragon Quest games. You have a party of four. You can choose whatever monster you like. And there's actually two different ways you can approach battle. When you're out on like the field maps of the game, which are called like the Circles of Nadiria, Navidra. I don't remember what the place is named. But you can either give orders to your monsters directly, like any old turn-based RPG, or you can basically set like a behavior for your monsters and then have them act on their own, and they'll basically kind of automatically behave roughly to the specifications that you gave them. Now, that actually sounds familiar to me, because I know like that's how the Dragon Quest arena works in some of the games, like Dragon Quest VIII, where you kind of collect a monster, and then when you do those monster battles for Mori in Dragon Quest VIII, they just kind of do their own thing. So you can play the game that way here also. And in fact, let me step back a bit. The structure of this game is basically you go out into the field, you fight monsters sort of in like this mini explorable zone. It's like an open zone map, but they're very small. It's like mini open zone, little levels really. And you fight the boss of the level, which is called in the game the Big Hitter. The Big Hitter. It's kind of silly. Like, I don't know why it's the Big Hitter is the boss. And each of these little mini zones has a Big Hitter. And when you defeat the Big Hitter, that actually makes the monsters in that zone easier to catch, Pokemon style. It's like they realize your power, your display of strength is better now because you defeated the Big Hitter. But anyways, you complete a zone, or maybe two zones, and then you go to the monster arena, and you do like a rank up match in the arena. And you start at like rank G, you go up to rank F, E, D, C, I think it goes up to B, A, S, X, something like that. I don't know, I'm not that far yet. But that's basically the structure of the game. You kind of are going in between like this, exploring these miniature open zones, and then like progressing through like these arena bouts. And these arena bouts are like a series of three battles. And the key thing to remember here, or to know here, is that the arena actually restricts you to the gameplay style where you cannot give orders. You have to play the mode where monsters can kind of act on their own. Which again, that's actually what I've seen in like the monster parts of mainline Dragon Quest games. So that's, like I said, I'm about 10, 15 hours in or so, and that seems to be pretty solidly the structure of the game. You're kind of going between, going through a zone, catching new monsters, leveling up your monsters. There is a system in place to teach your monsters some abilities and get them some stats and things like that. It's pretty straightforward. And then once you go through a few zones and have powered up a bit, you can probably take on the next arena bout. There are points in the story where you have to rank up in the arena to progress the story. So it's like, oh, you in order to talk to this next NPC, which most of the NPCs are monsters, you have to rank up in the arena first. And I'm actually still at the point in the game where there is not a whole lot of Dragon Quest IV like narrative crossover yet. Not really. I mean, there's Sorrow and there's Rose, and you meet another character named Toil and Trouble. I have a feeling that's not a very faithful local translation of his name. I'm joking. The Dragon Quest names always have meme-y, punny names. His name is Toil and Trouble. But anyways, the story so far is kind of like these little bit stories where you talk to a monster in one of these zones, and they'll be like, oh no, my son was captured by the evil demon guy named Raff. I don't know why the demon is named Raff, but that's his name. And then you kind of go through the zone, you go to find Raff, you learn that he is the big hitter of the region. You find him, you save the son, whose name I forget, and you kind of finish that little mini story of that zone, and you go on to the next one. And
Dragon Quest Monsters historically hasn't been like super big on story or plot heavy things.
No, and that doesn't really bother me. Like kind of expected it. And a lot of like monster raising games aren't really story focused, you know?
Yeah.
It's more of like the mechanics of just like creating your own team of characters and monsters. And that's where this game like really shines, is because there are like 200 whatever monsters in this game, and you can choose and pick and choose any four to create a team. And they all, different monsters have different like dispositions in terms of like the types of things they can do. There's a lot of flexibility in how you build your team. There's also a fusion mechanic in this game, just like SMT style, where you just take two monsters, slap them together to fuse into a new monster. So it kind of does feel like, I've never played a Dragon Quest Monsters game before, but I have played many SMT games. So like, oh, this is SMT Dragon Quest.
Does it scratch that itch? I wonder for people who've never played Dragon Quest Monsters before, like you, I wonder if that scratches that itch of like, hey, there's no like major Pokemon release out right now. We're a few months out of SMT5 Vengeance. You know, I wonder if it scratches that itch to like, if this, you know, release of a new Monsters game can expand like the audience to like people who are more familiar with like other monster raising.
I will say that this game does feel a bit simple in places. I gather that the Switch version was heavily criticized for its performance just overall. Just no one who played the Switch version said it performed well. And
that is correct.
And yes. Pretty much everyone knows at this point, just from history, from precedent, like, oh, this game is going to come to PC eventually. And it did, also mobile. But the thing is like, even playing on PC at max resolution, high frame rate, it's a pretty simple looking game. Especially coming off of Dragon Quest XI, it's like, oh, you know, this game does feel like it's almost like a generation removed. Even Treasures look better in some regards in some weird ways. But so my point is like, this isn't a game you really play for story. And I think the presentation is kind of simple, too. It's, you know, got the charming Dragon Quest art style and whatnot. But like, in terms of like scene direction, environments, character models, it's just relatively simple. So you're really hanging your hat on the monster raising. And I think so far it's okay. I actually am at the point, I'm at a point now where I took some thought and put together a monster team that balances itself pretty well. And I basically, I'm just kind of ride with that team as long as I can until they just kind of stop working. And then I'll change it up when I need to. But I've actually been riding with this team for several hours now, and I haven't needed to change anything. So it quite literally comes down to just me going into battle, clicking the auto battle button, and they'll fight for me. Run to the next battle, they'll fight for me. Run to the next battle, they'll fight for me, and they do fine because I set them up well enough to do fine. So I'm actually finding myself like watching YouTube videos as I play, which is kind of a I don't know if that's a good endorsement or not, that I don't have to pay a whole lot of attention to the game itself. Eventually I will. I imagine, hopefully, eventually my team that I put together will fall behind and I'll have to like replace them with newer monsters or whatever. But I've gone a pretty good stretch of the game just auto battling with the monsters I have. So I don't know. You couldn't do that in SMT5.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I assume the PC port performance is just fine.
You know, oh, yeah.
PC
like,
options, so.
I have no issues. Actually, I have the game pulled up. Let me just double check real quick. Nothing like super fancy, but it's not just super bare bones either. 1 second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always just that inevitability of just like, yeah, I would love to support this Switch exclusive Square Enix release, but we know it's going to come out on PC.
Okay, so it has actually it's maybe a thinner than I thought. It just has graphic quality low, medium, high, anti-aliasing low, medium, high, frame rate, V-Sync, and that's about it. So pretty simple.
Okay. I mean,
not even a shadow quality. That's... Like I said, it's a pretty simple game. It runs well. It's a Switch port. You know.
Are there any other remaining Switch exclusive Square Enix releases that I just forgot about that I've yet to come to piece or another platform rather?
Or was the first thing that came to mind when you said that was Foam Stars, which I know is not Switch, but it's a Square Enix game lacking a PC port.
Yeah, that is true. That is far sooner to no longer exist on any platforms
right.
than get ported to another.
Yeah, and you're going free to play with that fairly soon, I believe.
Like next month. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I remember last year.
Rebirth.
Oh, right. Yeah, Rebirth will eventually come. I have a feeling that'll be like next summer or something.
Yeah, I imagine. I'm just dreading the how much space it's going to take up on PC. Like 200 gigs. All right.
I remember when I was listing.
How much does Final Fantasy 16 require? Because that'll be the barometer. That'll be the bare minimum because obviously Rebirth would be more because it took like two discs as they were very eager to share in their marketing. So
I remember it was like an
Final Fantasy 16 scene page, 170 gigabytes of available space required. It's over. You're going to need at least 200 for Rebirth.
Oh, yeah. I think you needed that on PS5 too, but I don't remember. Yeah, so it's gonna be as expected, let's say. And I guess the big question with that in the future is like, how is the PC version, whenever they announce it and release it, how is that going to compare to like the PS5 Pro version, which is now a thing and is very expensive. But you know,
it's been very interesting seeing folks' reactions to the PC demo for 16 and its performance. And I've seen there's definitely some issues with the port that I've seen that's legitimate. And then I've seen people have been like, man, this runs like garbage. This is a terrible PC port. Forgetting that the PS5's GPU is a little bit slower than a 3060 Ti and it dropped to 720p in the 60 FPS mode in battles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have anything that's weaker than a 3060 Ti, you're going to have dips at like 1080p if you're not using DLSS or anything in like if you're trying to go for 60 FPS.
They have been releasing some patches of the demo, and then they said that they're going to apply that in the full release as well.
Yeah, they recently applied a second patch to the demo. So
we'll see. That's twice. I haven't tried out the demo at all because I'm like, I already played it. It's not really a priority for me.
I'll play it eventually. When it goes on sale for at least half off, then I'll do a replay and finally play the DLC. I guess.
I actually kind of, if I'm going to do a replay of that, I kind of want one, the discount, and two, I kind of want a mod that just unlocks all the powers from the get-go. So I have to like go through so many hours of the game again just to like actually feel like I'm playing.
I need someone to make a mod that makes it so that each of the different icons also has a different like basic moveset. Then that would actually make the game
I mean the problems with our grievances with that game have been well documented.
Back to Dragon Quest Monsters, I think I'll end with this. So last year, I played the PC port of Dragon Quest Treasures, and I wrote up a little mini review for it. I believe I said, like, if I were to score this game, Dragon Quest Treasures, I probably wouldn't score it very well, because it's got a lot of shortcomings. It's I don't think it works, you know, I don't think it all clicks to get together, but it's kind of a comfy game, but, and it's a little bit different, like in its structure and its style. It's probably worth noting that that game's pretty short. Like, you can beat that game in like 15 hours, I believe. Whereas Dragon Quest Monsters is already longer than that. And comparing Dragon Quest Monsters 3 to Treasures, Treasures is a very open-ended game. Quite literally, when you kind of get to the main part of Dragon Quest Treasures, it's like you have five continents to go to, and you can go to any of them and go anywhere and do something. It doesn't really matter the way that game is structured, where Dragon Quest Monsters is a little bit more structured in terms of like, do this zone, do this zone, do this monster arena, do this zone in this order. There's a little bit of flexibility, but it's not nearly as open. But I kind of think both games, I would call both games like a podcast game, because, like I said, it doesn't really, so far anyway, it doesn't really require my full attention. So it's kind of a comfy, casual-ish, I don't mean that necessarily with any, you know, meaning, but kind of just a kind of a comfy, simple-ish, charming game that does focus more on its like monster catching than, you know, an engaging narrative.
If you just have like get like, you know, your brain feels good when you like capture creatures and like fuse them and raise them and whatever, then that this is definitely a game for you, sort of deal. Because, you know, because the Dragon Quest roster like of monsters is like, it's very varied, you know, and you can, and there's an occasional recolor here and there, the same model, but overall Dragon Quest is like, it's a well-storied history of like, hey, there's like a shitload of different monsters in there. So that's cool. All right, moving on. Thank you, Adam, for sharing with your time with Dragon Quest Monsters the Dark Prince, the PC port of that. Colin is actually looking at the mobile release of that for us, since we got code for both versions, so he's gonna write up something for it. I don't know what to expect, but I think it's cool that Square Enix at least supports the mobile market with like premium releases, like Saga, for example. They are consistent with releasing Saga on mobile devices.
Yeah, so Cullen and I'll probably write up a mini review for the PC port of Dragon Quest Monsters, and we'll probably just combine Cullen's mobile thoughts into that. He actually took the mobile port and he ran it at the lowest possible settings just to see what it looks like. It's pretty funny. Those are always fun. Like,
it's good.
Take this game at the lowest possible settings and it looks like pixelated PS2, PS1 maybe even. Just like,
so you're saying it looks better then. Got it.
it's got more of a flavor, more of a texture when you when you can see those pixels.
It's like you're playing an older Dragon Quest game. I got it. So that's unusual. The Dragon Quest Treasures, that didn't get a mobile release, did it?
No.
Okay. All right. Moving on, there's a short thing, because it's kind of, none of us have been able to, on this podcast, has been able to get hands-on with the episode Aegis, but Cullen did review episode Aegis for us, and for the most part, you know, it seems to be, the reception to it is more welcoming than the original release of The Answer, because you know, people now know what to expect of it. While the original release of The Answer was a very kind of shock to people, because it wasn't the usual, typical go to school, raise your social links, and then go to Tartarus sort of loop. The Answer back then, and now with episode Aegis, it's more of a focused dungeon crawler experience that has usually a higher rate of difficulty than the base game, and it seems that they preserved that aspect in episode Aegis. Based on Cullen's review of it. So you'll have monsters that, you know, have definitely some devious resistances and can reflect and can null some of like your most, you know, go-to tactics that you did in the original game. And this is an especially kind of brutal experience for Cullen, because he couldn't carry over his data, because I believe he got Xbox code and he had his save data on Steam. So that was incompatible. So he had to basically start episode Aegis without being able to carry over anything. So it was just kind of like a fresh playthrough and seeing what that experience was like if you were to start up The Answer without any sort of like carry over bonus. to it. Did you get a chance to see that review, Adam?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you make of it?
So I was actually concerned that Atlas would like overcorrect and kind of remove all the friction from episode Aegis and, you know, basically remove all the teeth and just make it kind of like a, you know, almost like Persona 3 Reloaded, like the main part of it, where it's just kind of very, a much less challenging game. But it seems like that's not the case. It seems like they kept some of those devious elemental resistances. Some of the bosses, the element they're weak to, they will have the ability to dodge it sometimes, like the evade, the evade skills, which give you a chance to evade. They won't always evade, but they have a chance to evade. I actually have a friend who's playing this game on one of the harder difficulties, and they said they wiped out like 3 or 4 times already within the first day of playing. So it's like, holy shit. You want to be challenged and you play on a harder difficulty, you definitely will be. So I'm kind of glad that it seems like now that you do have a compendium, that was a big kind of, that was kind of a big fuck you in the original version. It's like, nope, you don't have a compendium and you will never get a compendium. If you want to fuse a new demon, you have to like get the original building blocks of demons and like start from scratch, fuse them together. You could never like recall one. You always had to capture them or persuade them and then kind of build from there. So you do get a compendium this time. So that I think is good. I think that's fine. But you still have to be careful in terms of like your persona, your party composition, which teammates you're using in certain battles, and, you know, working around these kind of devious resistances and things like that. It's still very much a dungeon crawler. So I know I saw some people saying that they still don't like this, you know, episode Aegis, because it strips away what they love from Persona, which is social links and the more calendar social elements of it, which is fair. That's what it is. That's just, I'm kind of glad that they didn't just keel over backwards and change the identity entirely. But they did make some adjustments to make it more approachable, not so much, not so asshole-ish, and so on.
I wonder, I didn't get to really, you know, I haven't seen any of like footage of like the if they made any sort of like story, not corrections or adjustments, or like the way that like maybe somehow some characters in the answer come off, because there are definitely some character developments in the answer that has caused some friction over the Persona 3, you know, fan base over the years, of like how some characters in their opinion like felt like it was like a totally like 180 direction of like how they first appeared. You know, there's some developments with them in the answer that's like, oh, it feels like they're feeling out of character. So I wonder if there's anything in episode Aegis that it felt like they still have the same development, but maybe that they maybe adjusted their lines so it's like it doesn't feel so so much of a shock, I guess.
Yeah, Cullen didn't go into specifics because, you know, you don't want to spoil anything, but he did say there were a few adjustments that he noticed, and one that he said he thought might be divisive among fans just in general. I have no idea what he's referring to specifically. It was around the ending. I don't think it would be like a major thing, but yeah, there might be some slight adjustment to lines or something that he felt was different enough to be noticeable. So, but I don't know what it is. I haven't played it. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to. This month is too busy. So is next month.
Yeah, it's a very busy time. Okay, so yeah, so that was episode Aegis, you know, the other significant RPG that released this week. Other than that, it's been kind of light on the lighter set of RPGs until some new ones come out next week. In the meantime, I checked out Space Marine 2, Warhammer 40k, Space Marine 2. A lot of people have been really, really enjoying this, myself included. I when the original came out, God, how many years ago? Like a decade ago or so, or a little bit more than that?
More than a decade. I remember playing the demo for the first one on PS3, to put it in perspective.
Yeah. So it's been quite some time. So I kind of I enjoyed that original Space Marine 1 a lot, and I kind of did a little replay, not the whole thing, but just like to remember, like, you know, what the mechanics were in that before Space Marine 2 came out. And they really, even though it's like obviously a whole new development studio, they really carried the spirit and the charm of the original and expanded it, the gameplay, in several ways. Like you can like now have parries in Space Marine 2. There's color-coded ones where it's like, it'll show stuff that you can parry, some that you can't, and even like attacks that like don't have a color-coded marker, you can still like deflect on your own. And it's really cool because when you do these, you'll have like a little reticle over the monster that you deflected. You can which you can do like a gun strike, which is like a zoom in close up shot that does a lot of damage. And then if they're low enough health, they'll do like they'll get into a range, like an execute range, where you can do like a button that'll like do a whole flashy finish. And when you execute a monster, you'll get an additional layer of armor. So there's like a cool, like sort of like expansion to the base gameplay, because the original was very much sort of like a more basic but very gratifying way of like, hey, you're shooting through orcs, you're using your chainsaw sword to go mob through them, and then, you know, if you did execution of them, you know, you'd regain health and so forth. But this one's like sort of more punishing, but in a smarter way, where like you're not getting like unlimited health refills. You're really relying on like your armor to get you through stuff. Even though it gets shredded really fast at higher difficulties, you really want to maintain that armor upkeep in Space Marine 2. And it even though it's a direct story sequel, stars the same protagonist, Commander Titus, and follows up on the events of that, it's still like, you know, a sequel that, like, even though you didn't play the original, you can still go into this one fresh and still have a good time with its own self-contained storyline. And also fills in the gaps of like, hey, even if you didn't play the first Space Marine, it'll get you up to speed on like all the, you know, relevant story details that may come up in the campaign for that. But the main RPG-ish thing about this Space Marine 2 release is there's three modes. There's one, which is the main campaign. It's very, very straightforward in that regard. It's, you know, there's not really any progression elements outside of like you're getting new weapons here and there to try out. And there's a PvP mode, which is very, very old school team deathmatch PvP, which is really cool because you have like different classes that have different weapon layouts and that, but it's very, very old school, which is nice and refreshing in this day and age. But the most RPG thing about it is like this new PvE operations mode, where there's like there's like six different maps, and these maps are happening in parallel to the main campaign, so they're not like just presented in a vacuum. You're like taking control of this like secondary squad that's doing its own sort of objectives to help support what's happening in the main campaign. It's kind of like two sides of the same coin of like, in the main campaign, you're Titus and his squad fulfilling this objective, and there are some things that happen in the campaign that may seem spontaneous because you get like sudden support, but then when you go to operations, you take control of another squad that like you're the ones, you're providing context of like, hey, they got support in the main campaign because of the efforts of this secondary squad. And the cool thing about the operations is there's actually distinct like job classes in it. You have like the sniper, you have Vanguard, you have assault, tactical. Then I forgot the name of like the ones with the shield, but they all have different layouts. Like the one with the shield has like a shield that it can defend itself with and a melee weapon, so they're more up close and personal. There's one that's like a more agile like assault where it has a jetpack that you can use to fly into enemies really fast. It has a secondary weapon and also like a melee weapon that it can spec in. I like this class a lot because it has like the power fist and a power fist in this game. There's one obviously that's like the sniper that's more hanging back. And as you're completing missions in this operations mode, you're getting experience based on their completion. So you get like experience of like just completing the mission, being successful on it. You gain like a small additional experience based on like if you had the most kills or the most revives or took the less damage and so forth. So small additional experience points in that way. And as you're leveling up your chosen class, you're actually getting like new perks from like a skill tree. You're leveling up like the weapons that you used. So as you level up those weapons, you can actually, there's actually like a selection of like how you want to alter their stats. So like a selection may be, hey, your secondary weapon is a heavy bolter and you leveled it up. What sort of upgrade do you want in it? Do you want to do more more damage at the cost of like a weaker sort of like defensive capabilities. For example, if you want to put like 3 points into the firepower of it, the one of the setbacks may be like, you know, you can no longer parry something. You can block, but you can't parry, which is, you know, that's sort of a trade-off that you have to make of like, okay, well, I really like parrying, so I don't want to do this. So maybe I'll take the upgrade that's like plus 2 to firepower instead, so I'm doing a little bit less damage, but I have the ability to parry stuff. And then it might be like, you know, it might be reducing spread as well, so you have less stray bullets firing off, or less recoil. Sort of like minor stat adjustments in that way. Same thing with like your primary weapon, if your class has a primary weapon, and the melee weapon, you get experience for those, and they have like different upgrades as you're leveling them up. And it's also sort of weird because like to get like to the next tier up upgrades, like as you're leveling them up, some may need like a resource from like that you get from bosses or doing like or like single player challenges to unlock like the next like rarity or tier in upgrades to do that, alongside your base character upgrades of like unlocking new perks for that each class. And each class in the game, it's like I think 6 character classes, has like their own distinct unique perk tree that you're leveling up, and they'll be like, you do more ground pounce damage from like the jetpack for the assault, and then eventually, you know, later upgrade like decreasing the cooldown on like your jetpack, and so forth. So even for like, even though it's like a third person shooter that doesn't really have a lot of like RPG mechanics, there's like a mode in that game that like if you really like enjoy just the base experience of like the gameplay loop of like, hey, it's a third person shooter, co-op shooter in that mode with up to 2 other people, and you're just kind of, I think the weakest point of the game is like obviously the limited amount of maps. It's only 6 maps in this operations mode right now. Down the line, they're going to add more maps, you know, throughout the roadmap and so forth. But it's one of those things, like it's a fun thing to do. There's like just to boot up, just like, hey, if you have like 30 to 40 minutes free and you want to have a good time, just, you know, play a map. I think that's also,
yeah, I actually have a question on this sort of,
yeah.
So my brother, who knows nothing about Warhammer 40K, saw this game and he's like, hey, this game has co-op and it's also cross platform. So we can play together, because he plays on PlayStation. I play on PC, and I only know anything about Warhammer through osmosis. So I actually went ahead and bought this game. I have not played it yet. So if my brother and I want to play this co-op, we don't know anything, how, like, what can we do? Can we just jump in, do the campaign together? Or is it just this operations mode that we can do? Can we start that from scratch? Do we start there? Should we start with the campaign?
So
you get where I'm going with this. Like, how do we play it?
So both of you can co-op the campaign if you want, and you can also co-op the operations mode as well. So both of them are co-opable. You can play together, no problems there. The only thing that you guys have to do separate is like there's like an intro level that you have to do, and then after that intro level, you're brought back to this home base called the Battle Barge, and there'll actually be a pop-up that says, hey, you can now co-op with another person. You can co-op the campaign together. But you can also just start operations right away if you just want to get to like the leveling experience of like the character classes. The only thing about hopping to operations right away is you can do all 6 missions right from the get-go, but there'll be several worries that say, hey, you know, there'll be spoilers for the campaign here if you do this level. And it's like very minor spoilers, right? But it'll actually have like a pop-up saying like, you know, just in case you don't want any spoilers of the campaign, you know, we recommend you do the campaign first. But it won't block you from doing it. It'll just warn you. But other than that, it's up to you guys whether you want to just do campaign all together or do operations or mix and match. That's totally up to you. There's nothing that's restricting you from one or the other, pretty much. So after that intro level, you guys are free to do what you want.
And is the character that you build in the operations mode, does that transfer over to the campaign in any way? Or is it totally? Are they like completely separate?
They're completely separate, both. Okay. So they're just nothing that there's no carryover, pretty much. The only restriction is in operations mode, you cannot be the same class. So you cannot both be both a sniper or cannot be both an assault. It has to be one of different classes throughout your group, pretty much. So that's the only thing. And that's pretty much it from what I can... Yeah. Other than that, it's just like, it's hop in, have a good time. You know, there's no... You can set it to whatever difficulty you want. You can make it as easy or as difficult as you want it to be. There's nothing restricting you. It's just, it's they're very good about giving control to the players. The one thing, the thing that really irks me about the game, and it's like, it's reminding me of like other games, and we'll get to that in a bit, but like, there are things in this game that like, it can be easily be done, like the home base, it can easily be done throughout, like as a menu, but instead it's like a whole environment of like, hey, if you want to get to anywhere, you have to like walk to it. There are some fast travel options, like the armory and like the audio log library and stuff. But for the most part, you have to kind of run on over to things in the battle barge if you want to get to do anything. If you want to start a mission, you have to, you know, get to the launch bay and then run to like the designated space. You can't like run. You have to like do like a jog to it in the main base. Which just reminds you of like other games, like say like Fire Emblem Three Houses and Engage, where like there's like this home base that could probably you want to get the stuff, but you have to like run on over to it instead of like it's all be done in a menu, easier, faster.
Before you even said Fire Emblem, I was thinking, oh, it's just like Fire Emblem.
So it does have that modern game design of like this home base that you have to run across.
I heard that the game itself, I've heard a few people say endearingly, the game feels like a long lost like Xbox 360 game or something.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, they're like the game, like the stages are fairly linear. It's point A to point B, and you're fighting a shitload of things. Like the game really excels at like, you know, it has like that whole swarm of like Tyranids, these bug creatures. You see that whole swarm coming for you, and it's like these things you can actually shoot at, you know, one by one in the distance. And then eventually you're going to have to fight them off as they come to you. And you just like, it's really good at like maintaining like a stable performance while encapsulating like the scope of like a big ongoing war happening, you know, all around you, pretty much. But your mileage will vary of like, if you're expecting like an Xbox 360 era shooter out of it and you like that sort of stuff, like that'll be great because a lot of times in the game, you'll get through this gameplay section. But then, like, the next objective is assemble. So all three of your dudes have to all get into one spot, and then you interact with the terminal to get onto the next section, whether that may be an elevator or a door opening or something. And then, once again, you go through this combat section, and then after that combat section, it'll be assemble. And then you have to all group up and then interact with something to go onto the next section, rinse and repeat until the end of the stage. And that's, you know, very reminiscent of that era. And in some ways, it feels fresh now because we've been so used to, like, how modern games are these days of, like, either being big open worlds or live services sort of stuff. And it's like, and so, you know, some people just kind of want to return to, like, what they enjoyed growing up, right? And that's kind of what the experience of what Space Marine 2 delivers is like, hey, getting that old school feeling. Even like what I said in PvP, it's very the standard team deathmatch. That's it. You know, the ongoing progression things in it is mainly cosmetic in PvP. And then obviously in operations, you have the experience trees and so forth. So
how long is the campaign?
The campaign is pretty short. Depending on like your pace of it, you'll be done like in 6 to 9 hours.
Okay.
So campaign itself, pretty short, but it's a nice, sweet, short and sweet campaign that doesn't really ever any have it doesn't have downtime at all, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then in operations, you know, that could be as long as you want it to be, depending on how many classes you want to feed experience to and rank up and sort of, but. You know, running through those 6 missions in there is, you know, fairly short as well. Like, the nice thing about the missions, like, I guess there's a divisive thing about it. The length of the missions and operations can last, like, you know, 30 to 45 minutes. And, you know, for some people, it feels like they drag on for too long and they wish that, like, even these missions were shorter to get their experience, you know, faster, because they are sort of commitments where it's like the fail state in between campaign and operations is different. In campaign, if all your dudes are wiped out, you guys are just warped to like the last checkpoint, and you try it again. You know, it's fairly close to like where you guys wipe pretty much in campaign. In operations, if all three of your dudes like go down and like are all wiped out and dead, you instantly fail the missions. You still get a fraction of experience, depending on what you went through, but you have to restart that mission from the start again. So you have to, you know, if you guys wiped, you have to commit another 30 to 45 minutes to try and finish that mission, depending on where you wipe. So that's kind of the thing about operations that's scary, where you have to make sure that at least one person is always alive to pick up the downed people, or if they're on a respawn timer because they've been down for so much, they have to make sure to stay alive for like at least, yeah, or at most 60 seconds, depending on where everyone's respawn timer is. So that's kind of the spooky part about operations compared to campaign, is the fail state on. Other than that, it's a blast. You know, it's one of those games that, you know, I've done with the campaign, I'm done with all the operations, and like I just boot up once in a while to either do an operation mission or play some PvP matches. And, you know, it doesn't feel like I'm married to the game that a lot of, you know, modern games want it to be, where like, you know, you have to log in and do your dailies, have to do your weeklies, and you know, if you miss those, then you know you're behind the progression curve. It's like, no, this is a very old school, like, you know, play it when you want to have a good time, and you know, and then obviously drop it when you're you know, when you're done with it, and then you can always return to it and so forth. So I think the main thing about this game is like, will it have a consistent like player base, like, you know, 6 to 12 months down the line, where you like, if you want to play an operations mode, you can play with bots, but obviously a real person is always going to be better than AI in that respect. So we'll see down the line if it has legs in that regard. I hope it does. So far, obviously, it, you know, a lot of people are playing it and having fun, but you know, the main thing is like, will I be able to matchmake with random strangers reliably in 6 to 12 months for this game? We'll see. Who knows?
I was actually just kind of thinking, like, this game is developed by Saber Interactive, and Saber Interactive is pretty big. They have like more than 2,000 employees, and they do a lot of like porting and publishing too for a bunch of different games. Like, they have their name on a lot of the Halo re-releases, Crysis on some of the Witcher ports, World War Z, Gloomhaven, Expeditions, Kingdom Come Deliverance, and a bunch of stuff. But like, I feel like in terms of like a game that is developed and published by, I guess they're not the publisher, that's Focus, but like they're the core development team behind Space Marine 2. Because I remember when I believe Bloomberg and Jason Schreier basically said, I think it's been softly confirmed that Saber Interactive is now behind the development of the Knights of the Old Republic remake. When that first came out, I know a lot of people, despite Saber being a relatively big company, were like, who is Saber Interactive? And this is kind of like, hey, this is one of the games that they made, like they're the core team behind it. So I'm not saying that Knights of the Old Republic will be anything like this. It's just that, you know, in terms of, if you're trying to find games that, like, what games did they make again? This is probably the highest profile one. So,
for sure. So hopefully that inspires confidence, you know, in the team, you know, now, you know, with KOTOR, the KOTOR remake being in development hell, hopefully this inspires confidence. So like, at least, you know, the crowd, like, you know, maybe they are a competent studio to, you know, take up this mantle, based on what they did in Space Marine 2. We'll see. Well, who knows? We have yet to see the light of day on that KOTOR remake ever since its announcement, pretty much.
Yeah. So I'm doubtful. Apparently it still exists, not under the original developer Aspyr anymore, but until we actually see something, you know, I'm just going to pretend it doesn't exist.
It's a good call. We'll see. Other than that, the last game we have on our docket here, just very briefly once again, a lot of people have been calling this their game of the year now. PS5 exclusive, Astro Bot from Team Asobi. James and I have been playing this, and we've both beaten it. I don't know if you've 100%ed it like I got have.
The platinum.
Okay, yeah. James, this is a pretty good game, I have to say.
It's a very good game. I'm going to say something spicy, and I swear to God, this is not me being a hipster. If you really liked Astrobot, you should go on eBay and buy a PSVR 1 headset for $80. You can find them for $80 on eBay. And download Astrobot Rescue Mission, because secretly, I think that's even better. And obviously, most people have not played that one.
Yeah, I remember that was like their first game, even before Astro's Playroom, that came pre-installed on every PS5. But like, I actually don't, like, all I know is that's a VR game. That's all I know of it. I don't know anything else
so
what it actually contains.
If you look up some gameplay of Astrobot Rescue Mission, you'll realize that secretly Astrobot is basically almost like a remake of that game. A lot of the stuff, like a lot of the games, like there's some stuff that's completely new to this, like the time power up, the and some of the other power ups. But like specifically, like the ape boss, that was in Rescue Mission. The bird boss, that was in Rescue Mission. The octopus, that was in Rescue Mission.
What the heck? Has Tina Sophie been lying to us all?
But that doesn't change the fact that Astrobot is one of the best 3D platformers of the last decade. But I just want to say it because I played Rescue Mission literally like in April at, when I was kind of getting back into VR. And it got me excited for this. But even then, when I was looking at footage of Astrobot, I was like, that's a lot of stuff that looks very similar to what was in Rescue Mission.
I mean, it makes sense though, like for them, for a reason, reusing like a lot of those assets, because you know, like the writing is on the wall that, like, you know, VR is kind of on the down slope, even though like it may have like some promising games in the pipeline. Just like mainstream acceptance of VR has like kind of been dwindling. So
it, yes and no. I think the main problem is that when it comes to VR, pretty much the only platform for VR that is doing decently at this point is the Meta platform.
But I don't think But even then, like, I don't think the rate of growth of VR has been, like, you know, like it used to be, like the initial prospects of it used to be really, really promising.
Yeah.
And then, but all of a sudden, it's like it's definitely winded down. It's like, okay, we got to set some expectations on, like, the VR market isn't going to grow as fast as we want it to. And will it ever reach the heights that we wanted? Will it ever reach the heights that, like, you know, we expected it to, you know?
So I've seen some genuine hype. I don't know if that's the right word for the Batman game. Is that out yet, or is it coming out?
I remember trailers.
Arkham, that's
coming out next month.
I've seen some excitement for it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think when it was first revealed with that like teaser trailer, people were like, it'll probably be just like a tech demo thing. Then they showed gameplay at Gamescom opening night live, and it's like, oh shit, no, this is an actual Arkham game in VR. It's got everything that you would expect or want, and I'm excited to play it.
Hopefully it's lengthy. Like, you know, hopefully it's like it has a good amount of time.
They said that they're planning for it to be about as long as Arkham Asylum, which good, because Arkham City and Arkham Knight are both too long for their own good. So
that's true. I like Arkham City a lot, but it does drag. So yeah, it's going to be weird because, like, you know, Rocksteady did not have a good year. And hopefully, obviously Rocksteady is not behind Arkham Shadows, but, you know.
Yeah. Maybe. I'm sorry for completely derailing this conversation.
It's okay. Yeah, it's okay.
I figured it was worth mentioning just for the fact that it's like, if you do like Astrobot, it's not that expensive to get a PSVR 1 headset if you don't have one already, and you should play Rescue Mission. It's an incredible game, and I do stand by thinking it's even better than Astrobot.
Is PSVR 1 compatible with PS5?
Yes, you can get an adapter for it. I think you have to order it from Sony, but I do know that since it's just like an adapter to get for USB, I'm pretty sure people have made like third-party versions of the adapter now. So, as long as it's USB, it'll work.
So if people want more
out extra money, wouldn't you just get the VR 2 and
it's not compatible with PSVR 1 games.
Yeah. Oh man,
it's kind of a weird point. It's like on paper, it seems like it's like Sony fucked up, but then when you think about the technologies driving both of them, it's like
that's what I was gonna say. Is like I've seen a lot of people have been like, oh, I'm not gonna get a PSVR 2 because they don't have compatibility with PSVR 1 games, and it's like, to the layperson that is not familiar with this stuff, that sounds like a perfectly reasonable stance. Yeah. The problem is that PSVR 1 is a platform that arguably should not exist because the way the tracking works is by using technology from the fucking PS3.
Yeah, it relies on like PS Move, like almost PS Move technology, right?
Yeah, PS Move technology, because you either have games that actually require the PS Move ones, like Derecine and Beat Saber, which is the hilarious worst way to play that game, is with the PS Move controllers on PSVR 1, or in the case of Astrobot Rescue Mission, it tracks the controller using the DualShock 4's light, which means that, okay, actually I do need to say this, not only do you need to get a PSVR 1, you also need to make sure you have a DualShock 4, because you need the tracking light in order, because that, like, one of the gimmicks that a Rescue Mission does, it uses the DualShock 4 more than any other game on that fucking system. So
there's some caveats for this.
That's a very high barrier of entry.
Yeah.
So if you are willing, then there's some advice there.
Didn't mean for us to be a whole conversation. I just figured it was worth mentioning because lots of people have been enjoying Astrobot for a good reason. I figured $80 if you already have a DualShock 4, it's a bit of money.
It's a large ask. It's a large ask. Like, if you have the disposable income, then and you're curious about it for sure. But it is a large ask for, you know, a lot of players.
And I will say, if you're interested in getting the VR, there are a lot of great PSVR 1 exclusives. There's the VR mode for Wipeout Omega Collection. There's Derecine, like I just said. There's a PSVR version of Resident Evil 7, et cetera, et cetera.
But you have to go down that rabbit hole of, like, do I need PS Move controllers for this game or not? So,
yeah.
It's, once again, it's large ass, also requires research as well. But, you know, there are options there. Other than that, I guess Astrobot fucking sucks. It's just doing Astro's Rescue Mission. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of people really, really like Astrobot for good reason. It is definitely just... It is a semi-graveyard for PlayStation IPs and other maybe third-party IPs that are represented in this game. But it is also just a competent 3D platformer as well that controls really, really well, very responsive, has a lot of very creative levels based on the power-ups that it gives you.
My favorite one is when you have the power-up that's like, we're just going to turn you into a mouse whenever you press the trigger.
Oh, yeah, because it's really cool because, like, it zooms. It's like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids situation, except that, like, it zooms in real time of, like, you being a mouse and everything is now big because you're small. And it's also really good in the sense that, like, it just lets you fuck around with physics a lot as well. Like, it'll just, like, have a lot of, say, like, balls or coins or dice, you know, or crystals. Oh god, the crystals. There are some levels where, like, there are these crystals on the ground, and as you're, like, you know, just kind of hitting them just to see the physics of them, I'm just thinking, like, man, the bitrate of streams must be, like, fucking suck for this. Like,
I saw a video on Twitter about somebody saying that we should be using graphical horsepower to, like, have millions of different physics objects on screen. They posted the ending of the tree level, Trunk of Funk, where, like, all of the apples just fall from the tree after you beat the birds. And the video, like, as soon as the apples came to screen, it's like, there is, like, exactly 3 pixels on the screen, and it's like various shades of orange.
Yeah. I think the most memorable level to me in that game, because I love the background music for that level a lot, is the level where you're switching between day and night in that game. And that's because I love the 90s cartoon-esque, like Disney cartoon BGM to it. It's very reminiscent.
Just reminded me of just made me want to replay Cuphead.
Yeah, that Cuphead too. I mean, that, I mean, I'm thinking way back, right? Because even Cuphead obviously is reminiscing those or building off of those as well. So me and my old brain is like, oh yeah, I love those fucking that era of cartoons. So yes, it is also very reminiscent of Cuphead and the BGMs as well. But it's just really fun to see, like, obviously the charm of like a lot of Astro Bot, a lot of the charm is like just seeing any sort of representation of like old school things that you remember, like Ark the Lad, for example, is there.
Okay.
Like,
okay. Yeah. Quick spoiler here. Mm-hmm. Quick spoiler here. So mark this on the timestamps. Team Asobi, you know that you can't just make a fully 3D Loco Roco level and then not make a full game out of that, right? Sony, yeah, let them make a full 3D Loco Roco. I feel like out of all of the hero levels that like directly brings gameplay from in, like an existing Sony IP, that was them just saying, we want to make a 3D Loco Roco. Let them.
Yeah, I mean, it's also the same thing for like Ape Escape as well. It's like, man, you know what? Like just having like a mini Ape Escape level here of like, you know, just having like the basic Ape Escape mechanics. Like, damn, this controls really well. Fuck. And it looks really good. Fuck.
Yeah.
Sure would be nice to have a new Ape Escape.
That's true, but like, like I feel like out of all of those hero levels, like all of them were like Astrobot levels with a little bit of a twist from those existing IPs. But the Loco Roco one was like, no, this is just a Loco Roco level, but in 3D.
No, yeah, I mean, yeah, the Loco Roco, the Roco level one is really, really good too. So, I mean, yes, for sure. I mean, honestly, the ones that, like, you know, were
the Horizon one was bad.
Yeah, the Horizon one and the God of War one were both, they're kind of boring for me. I mean, I understand why people, like, who are fans of them would love them. But for me, like is the Ape Escape one and the Loco Roco. Oh, these
I'm sure it was all right. It was fun one, just, like, spamming the paintball gun.
Yeah. Yeah, that one is fun because if you're missing anything from the gacha machine, you need some coins. That's a level that you can get blazed through.
Because really each fast. Enemy gives you like 3 coins, and you can, and there's so many of them, so you can just run through it and just get as much as you need.
That was the main thing that I ran like twice, I think, just to get the remaining gacha machine. Is that level?
So, I heard that Sly Cooper can be found in a jail cell, which is appropriate.
Yep. You can also find the dude from Wild Arms in there.
Rudy?
Dude from Wild Arms?
Yeah, Rudy. You can also find Jaster from Rogue Galaxy in there.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yes.
You can find Mr. Mosquito.
Oh, yeah. I've seen some people on Twitter being characters? Like, you can't tell
there,
me
there, there's a Dark Cloud 2. Dark Cloud 2 characters there.
Max?
He's messing around. Yes, he's there. And he's and like and the item you find for him is him messing around with the diorama town builder thing.
It's really funny how I feel like I was like one of like maybe 5 people that played that game that popped off when I saw Quill from the hit VR game series Moss.
I was like, I recognize that character. I think it's from Moss.
It's a mouse.
The one that like the characters that I didn't like, you know, see are like the more human characters, like the dude from hit VR game Sharpshooter. I'm like, I don't know who the fuck this dude is from.
I've never heard of that.
That was a VR game on PlayStation. Sharpshooter.
The one character I didn't see that made me a fake VR fan is the glowing Shiba Inu is actually from a PSVR2 game.
It's like Humanity, right? I believe.
Yeah.
I think even the VR component of that is like optional too. I think.
Are there any Square Enix characters?
No.
I was wondering, because they kind of have a PlayStation tilt, but, okay.
I think it's probably just a rights issue that there's going to be free DLC down the line that adds more VIP boss days, since I imagine that's when they'll add some Square Enix characters.
I mean, I wasn't expecting, I didn't know, and I apologize to people who may be getting spoiled on this, but like I didn't know there was those level 5 characters, Dark Cloud and Rogue Galaxy, like, okay, that's kind of cool. Yeah.
I think even Cloud showed up in Astro's playroom, I believe, if I remember correctly. But in here, like, there's just no Square characters. I have to imagine it's like a kind of just have something happen behind the scenes. I don't know, but you know, maybe down the line, even with the free DLC, they'll have the inclusion of those, because you have other third parties as well. You have like Ryu and Ken from Street Fighter, Kazuya from Tekken. They didn't even have any Mortal Kombat characters, I believe, either. So, I don't know. But yes, there are some definitely some deep cuts in here, even for RPG fans, of like, oh yeah, I remember that RPG franchise. Shame about that, huh? I'm trying to think what else was fun. I mean, Alundra, for example.
Oh, that's
yeah. That was I was like, oh, that's kind of a weird thing to to put in here. All right, but that's kind of like half the charm of the game too. It's like, oh, they put this character in here. That's
It'd be that's like fine. That Captain America's like, I understood that reference.
I mean, that's yeah, that's a lot of the game. And so I wonder. I guess the thing moving forward for this, right, is like one, obviously, hopefully gets decent enough sales to like, you know, inspire confidence for, you know, to let Sony have like give more creative freedom to Team Asobi. But two, also as well, like hopefully Team Asobi can find a way to kind of make a series that defines its own identity. It's not just like chained down by like references to like, you know, a graveyard of IPs pretty much. Hopefully they can find like an idea, because like as much as I like Astrobot, I think the weakest part about Astrobot is like the Astrobot mascot itself. It's very cute, it's a cool robot, but you know, the it doesn't really have any defining characteristics outside of like it's a cute robot. It's not like Crash, for example. It's not
Josh, I'm going to ruin your day again. Uh-huh. The final boss of Astrobot is the same as it's the same character as the final boss of Rescue Mission.
Great. Man. Awesome.
That like literally okay. The opening of Rescue Mission is you're on a mothership that has a PSVR like headset on it, and then it gets ripped apart by the alien dude, and he then takes the goggles and puts them on, and you have to get all the pieces of your ship back before taking back the PSVR headset by fighting him.
Does it I won't spoil the track, but does it have the track on the way to the final boss
No, okay. Because it was only with Playroom that they decided to go all in on the PlayStation nostalgia. So before, okay. Like, Rescue Mission doesn't have any of the references. It's only reverential to the VR headset itself, and oddly enough, very specifically DualShock 4. And to be fair, the way they use it in that game, I can understand. They did shit with that controller I did not think was possible.
Okay. All right. But I mean, yeah, so I that's the thing. It's like, okay, that's interesting that the actual Playroom, or not Playroom, Rescue Mission didn't have any cameos, because I think for a lot of players coming to Astro's Playroom and now Astrobot, is like, I think there's a significant chunk of the player base that's like, we like this game because it has so many references. You know? And I wonder if they feel, if they had the income, if they had the means to like say, hey, I want to go out and go try out Rescue Mission, will they, knowing if that there's no references, will that like be like, okay, but then what's the point?
What I will say is if Sony was very smart and they wanted to get a quick idea to see which franchises they should get Team Asobi or even like a section of Team Asobi to work on, they should just steal the idea of Funko Pops, but good, and just have a bunch of PlayStation branded Astrobot like figures. And it's like, okay, this one sold the most. This is the one that will fund for a revival. They should do it. Sony. Yeah.
Are you saying this knowing that the Funko game just recently came out?
I don't care about that because Astrobot actually looks good with those costumes on.
I just say that like that Funko Fusion game, whatever thing, just released.
Am I wrong? Like, I feel like that's genuinely a good idea. Probably too good for Sony right now, considering how they announced the PS5 Pro. Mm-hmm. But hey, what can we say?
By the way, that this isn't here or there, but that Funko Fusion team, like, they reach out to me like 3 times, like, please do an interview with us. And I was like, no, this doesn't fit our
show. Is that even an RPG?
No, I don't think so.
No.
It's, so am I not the only guy that when they announced that announcement, I'd like put my eye right at the computer screen just like see those sharpness difference? Am I not the only person?
Oh, I mean, that's a lot of people for the PS5 Pro comparisons. It's like, it was like the worst way to like kind of do that is through a YouTube video. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of the whole thing about that whole presentation, right? It's like, Sergey's a cool dude, but that was like the worst way you could like kind of market the PS5 Pro in terms of like showing the power differences.
Like, look at this sharpness. Like, See, I can't see the difference. It's
like, they're literally not going to be able to see the difference. Yeah. Like most people are going to watch it on their phones for one, which means you aren't going to see the difference.
Yeah.
The people that do have a setup that can see the difference, a 4K TV, YouTube compression is going to absolutely murder the difference. So it's like there was no good way for them to market this. And I understand that. I'm sympathetic to it. But you certainly don't do yourselves any favors by having the starting price be $780. I'm not saying $700 because anyone that's enthusiast enough to want to get a PS5 Pro cares about physical games, or at least wants a physical disc of one game. It's just bad.
Yeah, it's, I don't
know. You can even say 810 if you include the miracle
stands. It's also worth noting. It's also worth noting. The PS4 Pro was the same price as the MSRP of the original PS4 when it released, and then the PS4 itself got a price drop. So there was some goodwill there. This is $250 more at a baseline than the current cheapest PS5 you can buy, which itself got a price increase from the original fucking digital version's MSRP of $400.
And then we're also just talking about US dollars. The pricing in other regions is like just insane.
Yeah,
it just. So yeah, I mean, that'll come out, and we'll see what happens. I mean, a lot of people will get their hands on it, and it'll.
There's no way in hell this sells as well as the PS4 Pro.
I just can't imagine.
I think it's audiences, those very hardcore Sony like fans that are willing to spend on anything. It's like those Apple fans. It's like, oh, it's like, you're going to charge me $800 for a stand? No problem.
Yeah, I mean, the target audience of this is like for people who have very much disposable income, right? It's not aimed
for the normal audience.
Yeah, really. Yeah, it's not made for the middle class, for sure.
The problem is, though, and I understand the people that are arguing, it's like, well, this is... Once you get to essentially just under $800, even if a PC is going to be more expensive, you can build a PC as strong as this for around $1,000.
I feel like the people who haven't built a PC yet are like, I feel like those people are just never gonna, you cannot convince those people to get a PC, to build a PC. There are some people who are just like, no, I want a console. I don't want to fiddle around with a PC.
I agree with that. I just think that if you're part of the target audience for a PS5 Pro, there's at least a Venn diagram of folks that, because Sony themselves, when they released the PS4 Pro, they outright said that one of the reasons they did so is they wanted to prevent people from jumping ship from PlayStation 4 to PC. So that's like, with these pro consoles, that has been one of Sony's stated goals.
But like, I mean the landscape is different now because they're porting those previous PlayStation exclusives now to PC on a more consistent basis. Yeah. You know, so it's not really, as long as you're buying their games, whether on whatever platform, they're profiting.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we'll see. I mean, we'll see how it performs. It's expected to not be good, but we'll see. I mean, the numbers don't lie. At the end of the day, we'll see how that fares. I already know some folks, acquaintances of mine, that are going to get a PS5 Pro. No matter what I'll say to them, they are committed to getting a PS5 Pro. I'm like, all right, well, it's your money at the end of the day. And that's fine. So, that is our brief, somewhat brief tangent into not RPG stuff. Other than that, we did have a write-up from Chow on the site about Sword of Convalaria. This is a game that we've mentioned, you know, a few times here on the podcast. It is a free-to-play game that is on mobile devices and on PC through Steam as well. It's a strategy RPG. Chow, give us kind of like a summary of of your write-up here and anything you wanted to mention about your write-up about Sword of Convalaria.
Okay, so the reason I wrote this article is like I basically exhausted all the content. I beat every single difficulty, did everything. It's like, okay, I beat some of the story mode, and that's why I wrote the feature, right?
I thought you wrote the feature because you were upset at the misinformation about the pity system.
Well, the pity system is one of the misinformation that's been spread since day one. But I mostly just wrote it because it's like, yeah, I ran out of shit to do. I need to write something about it, I guess. I mean, I see Josh too wrote a feature article about Senless Zone Zero.
Yeah.
After like 2 months, like, okay, maybe I could write it, you know? It's like, you know, it didn't miss the mark. I feel like a lot of times, I feel like if it's not done within week one, then it's kind of pointless, right? So maybe
I think these like more. I think for these more live service games, I know Sword of Convalaria, you have said things to say about live service, but it makes sense to give them some time versus just reviewing them
on the spot, as soon as they launch. Yeah, it's always going to be like live service games by their nature are always going to be roller coasters. There's going to be high times, there's going to be low times, there's going to be low points. You know, just based on like what the current output is of the development team and how people receive the content that they roll out, etc.
Anyways, Chao's takeaway for Sword of Convalaria, you really like the story and characters, right?
I love the story mode. I am well. They just added a new story mode recently, and they actually completely changed the gameplay in this story mode. Actually, okay. So basically, in the story mode, you could join different factions, right? Like as soon as you like get out of like the prison, your protagonist can like join different factions, right? So you could either join the Union, which is like this neighboring country that is like very greedy about getting this material called Lucite or something like that. It's like a luminous type of crystal. And then you also get like the main kingdom, which is the Kingdom of Iria. Apparently the guy that's ruling it, people call him a dictator, but when you play through his perspective of the story, you're like, like maybe this guy is not a dictator, maybe he is, I don't know. You're just kind of like trying to guess. And then there is a different faction, which is this the Viter tribe, which is like these fox girls. They're like dancers and they're like traveling. And it's like, but they're also like a very small nation or something like that. So in one of the storylines, like you could try to get them to participate in this war to give them back their rights, right? And this new faction that they just recently added that you could join is the Element faction, right? Apparently these guys are like, what is it? They took over the world by storm at one point. And then eventually they just die off. So they're kind of like the Mongolian Genghis Khan era sort of people, right? And they're kind of like complete scumbags too, because like they do anything for money. And one of the things that they did is that they would kidnap those fox girls and sell them as slaves. And in the storyline is like, there's a big change in the storyline when they add this new story arc, is that you could join those guys, those merchants, right? And the fox girls basically said like, you work with those guys, now we do not want to cooperate with you. So it's like, you know, it's like a little bit change of alliance like would completely shift like the story apart, right? So that's like one of the things I like about the story, right? So I love the story mode, and I gotta say, like, this new story mode they added is completely different. So like the normal story mode that you do in Spyro of Destiny, you basically just do missions, you train, and you do whatever, and your week is gone, and that's basically it. The new story mode is you basically deliver supplies like caravans, and then your caravan might get attacked, and then you had to do like a mission instead. So it becomes like a whole trading game instead now in a new story mode, which is cool, I think, for a way to add a new story mode. Like they completely changed how the gameplay works. So I'm kind of looking positive what other kind of factions they might add in the future. So that's kind of like one of the things I want to add.
And the thing about this, I guess, is worth mentioning for people who don't know. It's like this single player mode is totally separate from the whole like greater free to play gacha game model within the same game, pretty much.
Yeah, you bring your level 99 characters from your gacha, is like they do nothing. They will start at like whatever the week is, right? So if you're in week one, your character's level one, so you can't like blitz through it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's meant to be like a single player experience, right? It's not. Your gacha can do nothing to it. Though I do hear in the Taiwanese server, it's like, I think they added a feature that it lets you use your gacha characters, because people were complaining that it takes too long to beat it, because it is too long to beat it, right? I think you take about 40 to 50 hours to beat this mode just to see one ending, and then later on you're like, oh, I just want to see the good ending, and you're like, oh, I had to play like 10 chapters to get to there, and you're like, no, I don't want to do that.
Okay, so if you want to see like the other ending, you'd have to like commit another certain amount of like hours from the beginning.
Yeah, because your checkpoint is like these beacons, which is like these gemstones that you can only set at like certain chapters. So you're like forced to like replay this large chunk of it, right? And sometimes they don't even give you like the good ending choices. Like I think in the Union option choice, you couldn't get the good ending choice because you didn't trust like Gloria, which is this knight, to like you know, there's a conspiracy and you didn't trust her early enough to like kind of help her, and you rather trust this prince, even though your dialogue choice is like you choose to help her, but your main character still choose to help the prince for some stupid reason, right? Mm-hmm. It's like it's like one of those things, and now you're locked out of like the good ending, right? And now it's like, oh, now that you play, it's like, oh, I can actually get the good ending this time because your main character actually ignores the prince and helps Gloria instead, right? There are something like that. So
yeah, so I mean, yeah, definitely give it a read. And you know, and some people have treated this game as like, I'm just going in here for the single player experience. I will try it out. I will download it for free and just get a single player game out of it, and I will not engage with any of the other free-to-play elements of it. And people have, like, you know, some people have done it like that, and like they seem to like enjoy themselves and have a good time because they're just treating it as like a single player strategy RPG traditionally.
Yeah, it's definitely fair. I would believe it's like, I just wish maybe if they sold it as a single player game in the future, maybe, I don't know, when the gacha dies, I don't know. But that's
I wonder. Whenever this game will inevitably reach end of service, you know, hopefully that at least part of it will be preserved. So,
yeah, because I think the story is great. It's like, it's definitely one of the highlights I have for this year. So,
And also, like, definitely, like, the soundtrack of this game, very good too.
Yeah, I think the people in the Twitter post like complained, like, what, we didn't talk about Hitoshi Sakimoto's soundtrack a lot. It's like, it's fucking god tier. It's good, but what am I gonna say? Music good. The end.
Good. Yeah, it's always hard to like, you know, put that into text, right?
Yeah, I'm also not like the biggest music expert. It's like, oh, it's like that, all these things with those notes, it's so good. You know, it's like, what? It's like, I don't know how to say that. So
the notes, they are good.
Thank you for reading.
So yeah, that's basically it, right?
Yeah. So thank you, Chow, for that write-up for Sword of Confluoria. Definitely, if you like strategy RPGs, and you know, have an itch for them right now, that's a good free one that you can play. You can just not worry about any of the free-to-play elements of it, and just focus only on that Spiral of Destiny story mode. Other than that, we are finally moving on to the news after a lot of sidetracking. Our first news story here is that Nanbu Works, a developer, will release a roguelike strategy RPG called Indomitable Blade on PC via Steam in 2025. Kite wrote this up for us, and one of the things that he wanted to pay special attention to is that they revealed that Yoshimi Kudo is working as the composer for this game's soundtrack. And Kudo's is known as one of the members of Hitoshi Sakimoto's Bass Escape, but has gone freelance since this year. And Kudo was part of Elden Ring's composer team, but also some of the works that Kudo has worked on is Unicorn Overlord, 13 Sentinels Aegis Rim, Odin Spear Lathrasir, and Muramasa the Demon Blade. So definitely one of the well-established composer.
Speaking of Sakimoto, oddly enough, I know some people, when they hear that something is composed by Bass Escape, they think, oh, it's Sakimoto, but no, it's his company, but there's several composers that contribute there, so with Yoshimi Kudo being one of them. And like you said, yeah, they've done quite a few games, like Unicorn Overlord earlier this year, for example, so
yeah,
really great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for right now, the only confirmed platform for Indomitable Blade is for Steam. We don't know if it's going to come to any other platform eventually, but you know, we do have a trailer and screenshots for it. And it, like, you know, this seems like a pretty cool looking game. Just like at first glance, you know, and it seems to, like, each of your units have as they level up, they gain certain abilities, have different classes, have different specialties. Standard strategy RPG sort of stuff. I don't know too much else, if they've shared anything else besides, you know, just some this trailer and some screenshots. But good on them, you know. This seems like, if nothing else, definitely one to kind of keep an eye on next year for strategy RPGs. We got an interesting...
This is the most interesting news of the week. For me.
For us. We got an interesting leak via Steam achievements on Steam DB. So there's an update to the Steam achievements for Shin Megami Tensei 3 Nocturne HD Remaster.
Which came out 3 years ago, to be clear.
Yeah. So this was applied and reverted on September 10th. They had Steam achievements that were clearly indicating that they're gonna re-release the two Raido Kazunoha Devil Summoner games back on PlayStation 2. So this was Devil Summoner Raido Kazunoha versus the Soulless Army, and Shin Megami Tensei Devil Summoner 2 Raido Kazunoha versus King Abaddon. And what do you think about this?
Okay, so when Persona 5 originally released in 2016, 2017, that was the first time we saw a lot of those classic SMT demons in like HD, right? And when we saw that, and like some of the imagery in that game, I specifically remember one of the Mementos quests where you see like a Baphomet in like this red dungeony room in that world. This was before, obviously, way before Shin Megami Tensei 5, but I was thinking, man, now that we have these high-res, high-quality demon assets, I really want to see that like PS2 era of SMT games either remastered or followed up on even more. That'd be even more interesting. So I've been waiting a long time for something like this, and obviously the SMT Nocturne remaster is a cool remaster. It wasn't the best remaster, but it was still cool that it's available now on modern platforms. So, like, I've been waiting for this. Either the Raido games or the Digital Devil Saga games. And after they released the Nocturne remaster, I was hoping that was successful enough to do more. And if I remember correctly, that remaster sold like 600,000 units, which, I don't know, I think that's pretty good for a remaster of a kind of a niche PS2 era release. So I'm excited for this. I have no idea why these achievements would show up on the Nocturne game page. Like,
what if they saw just this expansion?
That would like, be yeah, is this planned to be like crazy. An expansion to that?
No,
that'd be
way.
Weird.
That'd
be very weird. I don't know if they're maybe just testing like the build or the implementation, because I believe that game was running on Unity, and maybe they're doing something there. I don't know. But I think this is pretty unambiguous. Like, those achievements were uploaded officially to the Steam database and then removed just as fast. And they have pretty unambiguous names that are relating to the Raido games. So, like, it's hard to say this is not an impending remaster. Like, what else could it possibly be?
Yeah, so then we don't know what Atlas has after Metaphor v Fantasio, so they're fairly clear on like I can't think of anything they've announced after Metaphor release. Yeah.
So obviously, you know, obviously Metaphor is a game they've been working on for a long time. Shin Megami Tensei 5 Vengeance just came out a couple months ago, so like that team was working on that. Persona 6 is somewhere in the future; it's probably still several years away. So they need something, right? I think it seems appropriate that in the next year or whenever to have a couple more remasters to fill out the schedule. So, sure.
We will not say no to a PC release of the Raido Kazuna games.
Yeah.
I think the first
Raido game is probably one of the... So, for those who aren't familiar...
It's pretty jank from what I've heard.
For those who aren't familiar, most Atlas games are turn-based RPGs, especially of that era, or dungeon crawlers or what have you. This was like the first... How many action games has Atlas done? Not many. I know Metaphor kind of has like an action combat mode. Obviously, we're talking like 15 years later or whatever, more than that. But yeah, that basically the first Raido game on PS2 was an action RPG. And as Chao said, it's pretty jank. It's actually quite jank. Not necessarily the endearing definition of jank. It is just a janky game.
Yeah, it has interesting concepts, but
it's got a cool like tone and story and final boss and mood. But they really improved it a lot in the second game, which is the King Abaddon game. It's been such a long time. I think the story I didn't like as much, but the combat and a lot of the supporting systems are much, much better in that game. I don't know
if I remember correctly, like in the first Raido game, you can only have one demon out on the field, and then in the second one, you'd have two.
Yes.
And then obviously along, just like it moves better, it's much faster.
There's more, like the second game has the case files, it has, you know, I think if I remember correctly, the first game is also very restrictive in how you can heal, where the second game, you can just heal more readily. first game definitely has some of those more dungeon crawler like structure to it, despite being an action game, a PS2 era action game. I don't know if the remaster, how much they are going to change or tweak or not.
And I guess so, for people who don't know, like, that when you say action RPG, like, there's still encounters in here. It's not like seamless,
right?
In the world, like, you actually get into like a random encounter, and then you're in this closed off arena where you can move around,
beat up. Yeah, think like old Tales games or even newer. Yeah, ones. So they're individual battles, but it's not turn based. So
So, but this is very exciting nonetheless, and seeing like if you can get them like, you know, polish the visuals up just a tad bit, but obviously, you know, make it like support high frame rates and just make it feel more responsive. I wonder what else they do outside of that. This is cool. I mean, you know, I can't wait till they announce it officially, you know. Fuck,
you think they'll announce a Digital Devil Sega 2?
I hope so. That'd be so fucking good if they did.
I think overall I like the Digital Devil Saga games more. Digital Devil Saga is also just super cool. I'm also curious, like, what the Soul Hackers 2 team is working on. That's the, I know it's not as simple as we make it out to be, but that's generally speaking, like, the Strange Journey team. Then they moved on to Sharp FE, TMS, Hokuto Mirage Sessions. And then they moved on to Soul Hackers 2, but that was several years ago now. So it's like, I wonder what that, like, I think actually we've seen in a Famitsu post that Ishida, who was one of the directors of that, is working on something. We don't know what it is. It may not be SMT. I have no idea. But they're doing something.
Yeah, Atlas is in a weird state because they have, like, obviously multiple teams. You have Studio Zero on Metaphor, which split off from P Team or whatever the.
And assuming we're assuming Persona Team P-Studio. Is working on Persona.
Yeah, P Studio is probably working on the next Midnight Persona. So that how many other teams besides Studio Zero, P Studio, and that the Soul Hackers / FE / you know, do they have anything other studios that or teams that we know of
besides there's forever ago they announced the
Etrian.
Yes, they announced the next stage of Etrian Odyssey. That was when was that? That was like 2018 or something.
That was like right around the time they did Etrian Odyssey Nexus, and
it was right after that. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't believe it's dead yet. Specifically because they've commented on it, I believe, after the Etrian collection, I guess the Origins collection.
Oh, yeah, the Etrian remasters were like, yeah, this is like largely a testing ground of like to see how we're gonna make a game that doesn't have two screens. They're like, how the fuck are we gonna do it? Could you make Etrian without two screens? It's impossible.
I just looked it up at the end of 2023, so half a year, three quarters of a year ago. In 4Gamer's like end of the year interviews, Eiji Ishida, who was the director of Soul Hackers 2 and one of the directors of Tokyo Mirage Sessions, basically said they are working on a game, but it's going to be announced later. So yeah, they're doing something.
Well, so yeah, and I guess who did the Etrian remasters? Was it like that core Etrian team that largely worked on them, or was it like a outsourcing or not a porting studio?
I have no idea.
Okay. So yeah, whatever. If they have plans for Etrian, then that'd be another team. So
right now we're all in on Metaphor.
Yeah.
Can't wait to play.
So other than that, so we have some minor, smaller updates here. Nintendo continues its marketing for Legend of Zelda Echoes of Wisdom. They released a 6-minute overview trailer that largely, you know, just recapping a lot of the information that they've shared in the past with the Echoes, Zelda being the main character, overworld traversal, the still world, all sort of stuff. Like, they didn't really mention anything new in this overview trailer, just kind of a nice, succinct summary for people who haven't been paying attention to this upcoming release.
Watch out, folks. Stuff is getting leaked. So if you want to go into this blind, now is the time to mute terms on socials.
Yeah, there were some reports that like some like ROM leak was happening in this game too. Definitely be aware on that stuff. Pearl Abyss continues to show more of Crimson Desert. You know, they showed off the boss battles at Gamescom, but now they have like nearly an hour of uninterrupted gameplay footage. And kind of, there's also kind of the first news of like establishing the premise and the story of this game too, oddly enough, where they shared that like, you know, the game's protagonist is this man named Cliff. He was this leader of this group called the Greymanes, and you know, due to a skirmish early on in the game, him and his comrades are separated. So a lot of this game is traversing the world to reunite with his comrades to go fulfill some undisclosed mission. So the hour of gameplay that they showed off was a very early part of the game where, after recalling some previous incident, he goes travels to this town to go meet up with this alchemist. It kind of gets into this like weird imagery sort of stuff where eventually he's kind of like flying through the world, not falling down into the world, and then right before he like hits the ground, he like has this like pro form mantle glider thing that allows him to, you know, obviously escape mortal peril, but also just like, you know, you have some sort of glider flight system in this game to, you know, get some sort of verticality as you navigate through this. Also showing off, you know, more of the boss battles, duels, sort of stuff. So it looks pretty cool. I would definitely want to play it when it comes out. It seems like sort of my type of game. Even though I say it's sort of my type of game, but I feel like, man, fuck, I've been playing so many open world games this year too.
This year has like been everything but RPGs this year, so it's like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Adam?
Crimson Desert feels like an everything game.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of it, but the combat looks cool, though. That's all my brain makes out of it. It's like, oh, this combat looks impactful and fun and fast-paced. Oh, that looks awesome. Speaking of open-world RPGs, Ubisoft released another trailer for Assassin's Creed Shadows. It's like more of a world trailer, very brief, just showing like the graphical tech driving this game. The meatier part of this update is they released an interview that they had with some of the key staff in this game. That is art director, sorry if I have my mispronunciation with these names. So it's art director Thierry Dansereau and technology director Pierre Fortin on the graphical tech driving Assassin's Creed Shadows. So you can, you know, see what they had to say on that on our news post, you know, showing that, like, you know, there's like different graphical problems that they have to tackle because this has a real-time seasons change system. So it, you know, all the graphical lighting throughout the open world, you know, totally changes in real time and also changes the gameplay of the game too. So you can check that out there. We also got a new trailer for Beyond Galaxy Land, the gameplay overview. Adam, you and I have some, let's say, qualms with the way some of the narration is on this trailer. Okay.
So Beyond Galaxy Land is another one of those, like, we love classic JRPGs, so we're going to create our own indie take on that, which is totally fine and cool. You know, a lot of people make things that they're inspired by, you know. No problem there at all. But then there's always this tendency with these sorts of games, for some reason, where they're like, at least in the marketing, we're reinventing the genre and we're doing away with grinding and backtracking and all the tedium. And it's kind of disappointing where I know this is maybe a harsh way to put it, but it's kind of like saying we're inspired by these games you love, but actually the games you love kind of suck, so we're reinventing them. It's just kind of like, okay, there are maybe some early games with, you know, bad grinding or balance or backtracking or whatever, but to kind of paint that whole genre with that coat is just kind of like disingenuous almost. It's just like,
I don't think I've grinded since like the NES games or maybe Super Nintendo games.
Like, we've talked like early Dragon Quest, but then when they, like, we're talking like literally games that are 35 years old or whatever, you know, maybe some of the balance there, they're still fine tuning how these games should be structured, but it's like, come on, you're inspired by Chrono Trigger. Chrono Trigger does not have grinding. It barely has backtracking. Like,
it's the most easiest JRPG ever. You can beat it blindfolded. Probably.
And now, to be fair, this might just be a line in the marketing trailer that is whatever, still, it's just kind of like,
great.
You hear that and you just kind of like,
it deflates me out of it.
Yeah, it deflates me. So, I'm interested in this game. because I'm just curious to see how someone's take on these sorts of games are, but it's just like it's releasing in like middle of September, and we just talked about like, God, there's so much stuff coming out in the next 2 months. So I'm going to, they actually offered us review code for this, but honestly, I'm just like, I'm just going to see what the other impressions are. You know, I don't have time to check it out.
Yeah.
If people seem to really take to it, I'll check it out, but I don't have time to right now.
This is going to be off topic, but I'm going to ask you guys, does Fantasian require grinding, or you're just bad at game?
You can't really grind in Fantasian.
Yeah, there's no way to really grind Fantasian. You have to,
because you have level caps.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly how it works, but you can only get up to a certain level easily.
It's like more like Trails Curve, if I remember correctly. Like if you're let's say like under leveled, you'll get like way more experience off of that to like kind of get you onto like the same level playing field.
Yeah.
Eventually you get to a point where it's like you are at the appropriate level. If you try fighting enemies, you're going to get basically nothing. So you cannot grind anymore.
Plus one experience is like, great. Okay, awesome. So, and you know, the base difficulty of that, obviously they're going to add a new lower difficulty mode, normal mode. Yeah, adding baby mode.
All right, whoever plays baby mode gets fired from RPG Slide.
But the base difficulty of that game is tough. It requires you to exhaust your resources and your tactical strategies for like big bosses. It's like they will hit hard, and if you don't have a proper setup to counter them, you will fucking wipe.
I think everyone who played it here, I think Brian actually had some different strategies, but like for some of those like late game boss fights, like pretty much anywhere in the second half of the game, the character Ez, who is like the whiz kid, becomes like a crucial character because of his overdrive ability. Like he gives you more turns. And that becomes like so valuable. Like, he's like, he basically became a mainstay in my party.
Yeah. So. There's definitely like, you know, there are definitely like different viable teams for things, but like Ez just definitely alleviates a lot of like the, not the challenge, it's still challenging, but you have more options available to you because you gain additional actions. And, you know, a very key strategy for turn-based RPGs is like, if there's ways to give you more turns in your economy, it's probably going to be very good.
Those are usually the most broken characters in every RPG game. It's the one that gives you extra turn.
Yeah. So, you know. So yeah, Beyond Galaxy Land coming September 24th for pretty much all platforms. Yeah, all platforms. So, that's that.
This is the game where you have a hamster that turns into a humanoid hamster and gets a ray gun.
Yeah. Zenless Zone Zero version 1.2 is launching on September 25, adding Caesar, Burnus, Red Mocus, and Bizarre Brigade roguelike minigame.
So, Chow, are you an expert on Zenless, or did you give up?
I quit day one. I was like, this game sucks. I better go play something else.
Okay, so Red Mocus is like the Bangboo, which is like the little robot icon guys. Are those like regular characters or no? I couldn't tell.
They're like secondary characters that you don't take direct control of, but they enhance like certain things. Like a Bangboo will say, well, it has like a ice elemental attacks in your group. So like if you have an ice oriented team, you want Bangboo with you because it'll enhance like their how hard they hit because of their elemental archetype, and so forth. So they really only pop up like during like chain attacks, like when you fill out the stun meter or daze meter of an enemy. You can like rotate between your party members to get their hits in, and certain like bigger bosses that you inflict this on, they'll allow more chain attacks. So eventually, you can have like your Bangboo attack after all your characters get their rotation in for them. So they're like a minor element, like part of your team building, but they are important in terms of like if you're optimizing like damage numbers pretty much in your team. But they're not directly playable other three characters in the team. I don't play this game anymore, but I remember that.
Yeah, I quit like day one. I was like, I have no interest in this game. I'm just gonna go back to playing either Genshin or Honkai Star Rail. And even I haven't played the new Genshin.
I have a rule, and I stick with this rule, is like I only play these free to play games if I have no other real game to play. Right now I'm playing a real game that I cannot talk about yet, so therefore I have stopped playing all the free to play games that I've been playing. So I haven't even logged into Wuthering Waves ever since like PAX.
Nice.
Meanwhile, I'm in the same situation, but I'm currently scheduled to do the newest WoW raid tonight. So
Good luck. Let us know how that goes.
It's normal mode. It won't be a problem.
Yeah. I haven't kept up with 14. I completely dropped. I heard it got really toxic in this patch for some reason.
So this is neither here nor there, but 14's whole community is completely on fire right now because of the best way of putting it is it's having its Me Too movement.
Okay, well, I don't know. I don't know anything about F14 and what's going on in it, but all right.
You don't want to know. Okay, you don't want to know.
All right. Okay.
Anyone that plays 14 is even remotely like logged in on the community knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's just it's not great.
So moving forward, Kite has updated us with Square Enix has unveiled their Tokyo Game Show 2024 lineup. Tokyo Game Show is happening at the end of the month. James will be there.
Yep.
Be on at the scene. Gonna be reporting on what they've been, what everyone's gonna be announcing there.
What I can say about the Square Enix thing is that I've already been reached out to, and they've told me. We have Fantasian playable. Wait. It's a different build from what you guys played at PAX. So I will be playing Fantasian right up another.
That's pretty nice that they let us know. It's like, hey, it's a different build from what you played. It seems like the Fantasian people seem to really like that PAX West preview. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure it also helped that we were the only outlet to give it.
I mean, hey, Matt, it deserves it.
Yeah, I'm so hyped to play this game that I don't have to sign up Apple Arcade anymore for it.
Yep.
So some of the games, well, all the games that Square Enix is going to be showing up there, as far as they have announced, maybe they'll surprise us with something. Who knows? Obviously, Dragon Quest III HD 2D Remake is going to be there, because that's going to be releasing soon. The Romantic Saga 2 Remake, same boat. Revenge of the Seven, going to be there, because that's releasing soon. Fantasian Neo Dimension, still doesn't have a release date, but still going to be out this winter, supposedly. FF14, going to be there. FF16, because of its PC release, coming up soon. Going to be there. The new Life is Strange Double Exposure game going to be there. Dragon Quest Monsters 3, The Dark Prince, also going to be there. Power Watch Simulator and Visions of Mana as well. So
I think some of those are just trailers.
Yeah.
Like, I think Visions of Mana is just going to be trailers, which is sort of weird. Like, I know the game is out and people are always looking for the next new thing, but, you know, that doesn't hurt to have a demo for that if people want to check it out, even though the game is out. But it's just going to be a trailer thing.
Yeah. So, other than that, I mean, obviously, there's going to be a whole lot of other companies going to be at Tokyo Game Show, Bandai Namco.
I looked at what Square Enix announced last year. I don't think Square Enix usually announces new stuff at Tokyo Game Show. Usually, they just, like, update games that we already know about. Like, last year, they had a new trailer for Saga Emerald Beyond. They had a new trailer for the Switch version of Dragon Quest Monsters The Dark Prince. And Sony had an event a little bit before Tokyo Game Show, and that's when they, I think that's when they dated, or at least had a new trailer for Rebirth. We're not getting any sort of equivalent Sony event this year, are we? Or are we?
I don't know. There's been rumors that people are saying that like a State of Play might happen at the end of the month, but I don't know if it's going to be before Tokyo Game Show or...
Because I think in previous years, it's always been like a week before Tokyo Game Show, and it's like, well, we're almost there, so...
I mean, if they were going to theoretically do it, they would, like, announce it, like
Monday. And then
either, either Monday or something. Like, but it's sort of weird in this respect, right? Because Nintendo, like, when they announce their, like, directs now, it's usually the day before. It's like, oh, yeah, by the way, in two or 3 days or tomorrow, we're going to have a direct. It's like, oh, okay.
Within 48 hours, usually.
Yeah. So, like, and Sony's, I think, been trying to, like, do that as well. So it could be fucking any time, I feel like.
Right.
So, I kind of wish they kind of gave us a bigger heads up, other than like, hey, either tomorrow or the day after, we're gonna have like a big ass event, and we're probably gonna have a shitload of news. But you know, that's just the state of things now. Level 5 is gonna be there.
I'm
on Ichi Software.
I'm still debating if I'm going to try and play Layden at the level 5 booth, because it's like, they have Fantasy Life playable. They have Layden playable. I think they have Inazuma 11 playable, but I don't know anything about soccer. I'm a dumb American.
What about Mecha Police?
They do not
Deca Police is not playable, even though it was playable last year. And it was very polished when I played it last year. I don't know what's going on. But
no, that doesn't sound good.
Kind of weird.
Yeah,
Sega Atlas going to be there. Sony going to be there. So, I mean, you know. Well, Tokyo Game Show coming soon. Not in this next week, but I think the week after.
Yeah, I was hoping that Telya Yumiya yeah. would be playable, but it's not playable, so. Fairy Tail 2 is playable.
There you go.
Oh, no.
Time to read the manga and catch up.
That's right.
Yeah.
Look, even Paul suffered. He reviewed the I Reborn as a Slime, whatever. It's like, he did not like it. So I tell you, don't play anime adaptation games. Enough said.
That's Chow's campaign. That's the slogan he's going with for his campaign. Developer Rainy Frog and Forever Entertainment, they're gonna show off finally the Front Mission 3 remake on Switch at Tokyo Game Show. So the Front Mission 3 remake was announced quite a while ago. It was
I want to say February 2022.
Okay. Yes. Sure. So, and then we haven't heard from it since because we were waiting for the release of Front Mission 2 Remake. And it's been some time since then. I don't know what the state of that game is since it came out on PC. I don't know if they ever, like, updated the localization on it or whatsoever. I don't know if they got their issues ironed out. I just know it was a rocky launch for the remake of Front Mission 2, both on Switch and then sometime later on PC.
Well, at least we don't have to worry about the localization for this one. I mean, they could just use the PS version as their translation base, right?
One would hope. But, so we'll see it for the first time, finally, this remake, how it's been coming along at TGS. And so I'll have a demo for the Switch version on the floor there.
So what do you think it'll look like? Do you think it'll look kind of close to the PlayStation 1 version with the low poly? Or do you think it'll be a little bit...
It'll be probably on the same level as, like, the previous remakes that just... They're more higher fidelity, but kind of lose something in the process. I think it'll look as similar as the previous remakes. You know, they're more 3D polygonal. I kind of prefer the original look of the games, but that's just me. I haven't really felt very strongly at the Front Mission, any of the Front Mission remakes yet, which is kind of a shame. You know. We'll see. Front Mission 3 was a good entry, but still, I think Scars of the War, was it 5?
Yeah, that's 5.
That was really good. Front Mission 4 also really good.
Yeah, I believe 5 is like the best one, but there's no way to play it officially. You only have to like rely on an English patch that's out there.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, obviously they're working towards the stronger later entries. I don't know what they're going to do with them, if they're going to get there.
They have not said anything about anything past 3.
Yeah.
They basically originally announced it 1, 2, 3.
So. Yeah, that's it.
Unless you want to check out Left Alive. I feel like, oh my god.
No, like it's okay. Stop reminding me of that game. That didn't happen. Raynatus, that is coming out fairly soon, September 27th. There's a demo out for that now on PS5, PS4, Switch, and PC. Adam, you've checked out the demo. It was like short, right? I believe.
I don't know. I had played the game. So
okay.
I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but I played it. Whatever.
Okay.
Just pretend I played the Japanese version or something. I don't know.
Okay. So, got it.
The Japanese version's been out.
Yeah.
That's a very low
Amazon. So, impressions next week, I think.
Got it.
But basically, the demo is it's apparently the beginning of the game, but there is no direct save transfer to the full game that a lot of demos have these days. It's you get some bonuses, and apparently it even NIS America even said that like the bonus you get is dependent on like how you complete the demo, so you actually have to complete it. I know some demos you just go into the demo and make a save file and then you get the bonus. That's all you need, but you have to complete it. So I don't know what the bonus is.
They're still arguing about the save file thing. It seems like there's like three people arguing. It's like, oh, no, it does. It's like, it says it over here. And the other guy's like, no, it doesn't. It's like, what the hell are people arguing
about? Well, there's like some miscommunication of like whether their save progress transfer or not. Or the way
Wait, for what? Right?
For Raynatus.
Yeah, I guess there's people arguing on Twitter on the save file transfer or not.
I saw someone say something. I posted the news about the demo, and I said, there's no save transfer, but there is a bonus. And I'm just relaying what they said, what NAS America said. So I saw that there was some response, like, what's the point if there's no save transfer? It's like, eh, whatever.
There were times when you just wanted to try out the game just to see what it was. And there was
Remember demo discs? Those were always fun.
That was crazy.
Yeah. What is it, PlayStation Underground?
Yeah. What? Remember those times when you just played a demo to see what it was like, and, you know, it wasn't expected for save data transfer?
I remember getting a demo disc, like, really early in the PlayStation 2's lifespan. I remember it had Final Fantasy X. It's kind of funny. Final Fantasy X, for us, how good it looks on PS2, it's hard to remember. It was a very early game, relatively. Maybe not first year, but, like, within, like, the second year of the platform. I remember it had Eco on it.
God, that's such a good game.
What else did it have? I think it had some sports game. Maybe Jak and Daxter. Yeah.
I apologize for bringing it up yet again, but did you know that there were actually demo discs on PS4 specifically for PSVR games?
Really?
There's three of them. Three of them.
I didn't know they existed.
Yeah, one second. So I'm just going to post these in the voice channel chat so you know I'm not making this up. Demo disc one. Demo.
We're getting photo evidence.
Demo disc two.
Yeah, it says PlayStation VR demo disc on these for PS4. And there's a.
And then it does say
demo disc 2.0.
Yeah.
I see a moss on this cover. I see a dinosaur at the right.
I don't know what the difference was between 2.0 and 3.0. There was a difference.
How do you get these demo discs?
One of them actually came bundled with, which is why you'll notice that, like, some of these are soft covers, but you could actually get them.
And obviously that
you could download the demo disc collections digitally too. So you didn't have to actually have the disc, but the fact that there was even a disc that you could get, it's like demo discs still existed on the PS4. It's crazy.
So is that Ryan on the upper right, or is it some Warframe wannabe guy?
I don't know, Chow. These are hard questions. I don't know any VR games, dude.
Okay, I have another question for you. Were you one of those guys that bought Zone of the Enders or Zone of Enders to play the Metal Gear Solid 2
demo? I bought it for Zone of the Enders, actually. I mean, I was just like, oh, cool mech game. I could have sworn
back in that time so many people bought that game just to play the Metal Gear demo.
I don't think I bought it. I rented it. And then, sure enough, I beat it because it was a fucking short game. I don't know if it gave it a demo disc or not for the rental. Those are good times. Anyway,
so
moving on, the third and final DLC to Remnant 2 is coming out on September 24th, is Remnant 2 The Dark Horizon. And at the same time that this third and final DLC is coming out, there's going to be a free update as well that adds new modes to Remnant 2, like a free boss rush mode update.
Remind me, Remnant is developed by Gunfire Games, published by Gearbox Publishing, that was under the Embracer umbrella, but now Gearbox is owned by 2K because it was sold. How does Remnant fall in now?
Based on the Steam page, it's now the publisher's Arc Games, not Gearbox anymore.
Arc Games is Gearbox, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know.
Yeah, no, Arc Games is the new name for Gearbox Publishing.
Okay.
Because Gearbox was bought out by Take-Two. Right. So, and they had a huge round of layoffs. Big shock. There hasn't been a single week this year where there wasn't a huge round of layoffs somewhere. We didn't even talk about the Activision, Blizzard, Xbox ones that affected, like, WoW, because we're covering WoW now.
Stay tuned. Yeah, so basically Gearbox Publishing transferred Remnant to Arc Games, which is under Embracer. So that means Remnant 2 is still under Embracer. Okay.
Yeah. I remember they did that split. I was like, oh wait, Remnant 2 is still with Embracer. That's right.
That's why I asked. It's a little confusing.
Yeah, that's right.
So
part of the free part of the new paid DLC update, the Dark Horizon DLC, there's a new glider traversal system just for the world of Nerud that it's affecting. Obviously, they're adding a new archetype, the Warden, which is almost looks like a pet-based class, but your pet is a drone that can shield, heal, or even attack enemies. So they're going to show more of that in the upcoming week. Obviously, new bosses, new items to encounter in that paid DLC. In the free part of the free DLC, the Boss Rush update, there's a good way to like get any perks or weapons that you've missed, because like as there are some weapons that you only get from beating bosses in the game, so there's a good way to kind of just like fill out your weapon inventory based on like the items that you get from bosses to go craft them. So then there's like different options for the bosses. You can do like a 3-boss run, a 7-boss run, or if you're really really dedicated, you can do a 19-boss run, and all that sort of stuff. That's cool. Once again, both that new paid and free DLC update is coming September 24. 8-Bit Adventures 2 is coming out October 16 for PlayStation 5, PlayStation 4, Xbox Series X and S, Xbox One, and Nintendo Switch. So this is like there's the console release of 8-Bit Adventures 2. This originally released on Steam in the end of January 2023. When I was looking at previous news posts for 8-Bit Adventures 2, I saw that Adam wrote about the release date of it coming to Steam, and the blurb he used it was in quotes, so it came from the developers and publishers themselves saying, "Everything you love about classic JRPGs with all of the charm, heart and soul, but none of the inconvenience."
Yeah.
Well, if you want to be inconvenienced, where's the challenge?
So it's funny because I wrote this up after doing the Beyond Galaxy load. I was like, oh, here's another example of, you know, we want to make an RPG, but we want to convey the message in our marketing that, you know, there's no inconvenience like the older RPGs that really wanted to inconvenience players. Right, Adam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When did JRPG got this stigma of being inconvenient type of games to play? Tell me that.
Well, you know. But yeah, that's the console release of that is October 16th. Neptunia Game Maker Revolution coming to Xbox Series X and S on October 29th. They love their staggered marketing for the Neptunia games. They really want to be in the news cycle. So here we are with it coming to Xbox Series.
I remember a few weeks ago, like, they said, oh yeah, it's going to come out this month. And it's like, okay, do you have a date? And I even told Adam at the time, I'm not covering this until they reveal the date.
Yeah, because they want to stagger the marketing. They want to announce the month and then a few weeks later announce the day. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and you know they're not the only ones who do this too. Like a lot of like indie games as well. Like they have like a certain news program for this live stream, and then for the PC gaming show, they're gonna have the date there, and then a stream before the PC gaming show, you'd have like the month there. It's like
Sega Atlas does the same thing. It's like, man, if you only ever watched the first versions of every trailer they put out, you'd think that they only release their games on Xbox.
I mean, to some extent, there's some people that still believe that. So, a game that actually gave us a release date and not just a month, Ender Magnolia Bloom in the Mist will exit early access and enter its 1.0 release on January 22nd, 2025 for PS5, PS4, Xbox Series, Switch, and PC.
I remember last week we were concerned that this was targeting like November. It's like actually end of January is probably better. So
yeah, that's a great release date. So I interviewed Kobayashi-san, CEO and creative director of Binary Haze Interactive, and he mentioned that they expect that they're going to finish up development in November, not necessarily release in November, but they said they expect to finish up development in November, and then they gave us a release date of the full release of this game. That is the end of January next year. That's I should probably do like a full play and finish of Ender Lilies before checking. Yeah, I mean that what I played at PAX West though was really, really cool. So I'm sure I'm hoping it's as good as Ender Lilies and has as much of an impact, if not more, Ender Lilies. Because that first game was very, very, very successful for them. So that's yeah, very soon. So that's another RPG release for 2025. We have yet to know the release date of some of the heavy hitting RPGs of next year, like Monster Hunter Wilds. Though we're still waiting for the release date.
That could very well be a TGS thing for sure.
Yeah, maybe, probably going to be revealed there at like a stage or something.
It's gonna. We're all dreading the release date of this.
Fun fact, I do not have a Capcom appointment yet. I am assuming that since Alex played Wilds at Gamescom, they're like, this is TGS. Everyone, their mother is going to want to play this game. And it's the one main thing we're showing off. We're not going to whatever. But so I'm going to have to wait in line to play it. Fun.
Yeah, I didn't have a chance to play it at PAX Fest because my schedule was just too packed. So unfortunately, like I got to see people play it there. I'm like, and I saw some hardware failures at PAX West because PS5 and overheating, probably. You know, that's what happens.
I think they the had PS5 is too in strong. The cage. I don't know about you guys, but the PlayStation 5 like trips my power sometimes. I have to like reset the breakers to get the power back on.
That you have too much connected to that one circuit. Like how much, like. How many things do you have connected in your room?
I have an LG TV, I have a speaker, and I have a PlayStation 5.
That's it?
That's it.
What are you on right now?
What do you mean?
Is that his computer's in another room, right? It's not in your room?
Yeah, I'm playing on my computer right now.
Okay. Then I don't know. That sounds like something wrong for circuitry. I don't know what to say.
Look, my computer never trips my power. Only the PlayStation 5 does.
Yeah, it has to be something with your circuitry. I mean, you know, this neither here nor there. But thank you, Adam, for the nice SpongeBob Squidward staring out the window gif saying Josh watching PAX attendees that play Monster Hunter Wilds. Thank you. That's exactly me, actually. Fuck.
Just imagine the window, any window meme where Josh is longing for the playing Monster Hunter Wilds, but he didn't get to.
Oh man, I really wanted to use the media hour thing to just play it without any line to worry about, but no, Nintendo's like, you have to go play Zelda during that time. I'm like, okay, Nintendo, I guess I'll play Zelda. It doesn't matter, I'll play the fucking full version of Monster Hunter Wilds. I'm hell or high water.
Wow. I've said this before, but I'm the one who takes care of our RPG release date list on our site. I hope you guys find it useful. Seems like I've talked to people at Summer Game Fest, seem to like it, so I'll keep doing it. I usually post the next year's list after TGS, so it's pretty soon here.
Yeah. So
Because we'll probably get a few more dates and whatnot locked in at that point, so that's usually when I'll post it.
So we'll see. I mean, the TGS, I don't know what to think going into this year's TGS. I don't know if I should be excited or I'm just like, yeah. I mean, you never know, because last year they announced fucking this week, or not last year, 2 years ago, they showed off Suikoden 1 and 2 HD remaster. So sometimes you just never know what to expect.
Are they like Konami song and music video? Like Odin 2?
I don't know. Who knows? Maybe Konami has another HD remaster fucking announced there out of nowhere. Who knows? Maybe it'll be like, because we love you so much, I'll do Suikoden 3 to 5 as well.
It's going to be 5. I don't really care about 4 and 3 much, really.
You're going to get Suikoden Tactics and you're going to like it.
Yeah, that's right.
No.
Well, and that's it. That's the final news story for this week for RPGs. I don't know. Let's see. Next week, what is coming out next week?
Final Fantasy 16 for the first time.
Yeah, for the first time.
Is that one of the expansions again? I forgot.
Those are separate.
You can buy them, but they're not included.
Yeah, so, they can get like a bundle, like a complete edition of F16 that's bundled in with them. Mm-hmm. Other than that, though, FF16, I'm like looking at the calendar. What's the date next week? Oh, okay, got it. So yeah, FF16, Jedi Survivor. It's not really RPG, but Jedi Survivor is coming out on last gen console for PS4 and Xbox One.
Insane.
So it'll be interesting to see how that does.
There's Anatria.
Yeah, and oh yeah, Anatria, the Lost Song.
The Plucky Squire, which actually I am excited to play that. Yeah, I think it's on Game Pass. Yeah.
I did see like the Digital Foundry video on that. That looks really cool.
God of War Ragnarok on PC. Right. The Dead Island. No, sorry, not Dead Island. The Dead Rising remaster.
Frostpunk 2. We actually got someone actually reached out to me asking me if we wanted to review it on our RPG site. I was like, probably not.
Yeah. So, I didn't notice that UFO 50 was coming out this week. It's not not an RPG, but that is
a game that's coming out.
Yeah, UFO 50. It's finally coming out. Apparently,
I didn't realize it had a date.
Yeah. Fuck. So yeah. That's gonna be. I don't know. I'm definitely gonna.
There's that. RPGs in it.
There are.
So, I mean.
Oh yeah, that's
true.
There's
definitely RPGs that are like one. One is. I played it at Summer Game Fest. There's definitely an RPG that's like Dragon Quest. Tilted, I guess, and then there's another that's clearly like inspired by Phantasy Star. So
maybe I'll check those out. So yes, that's the biggest RPG, the UFO 50.
There's also an RPG that's like an underwater RPG that sort of reminds me of Echo the Dolphin if it was an RPG.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I unfortunately I do not have time right now for Anatria. I am busy with other things, but I would. If I wasn't busy, I would definitely check out Anatria. I'm very interested in how that game shaped up, and obviously the biggest thing is the saga that they went through to get that out. Obviously, it's only going to be coming out for PS5 and PC, and then eventually Xbox down the line because of the saga that they had to go through, as we mentioned in last week's podcast. And yeah, that's... Other than that, that's the week ahead for RPGs and other significant titles that we're interested in. Anything else I'm missing, folks? No. Got it. Until then, you can find us at rpgsite.net. That is our main site. And then you can find us, Twitter/X over at rpgsite. And all our other socials, you can find us on Discord as well. We have that linked at the top of our site. Go check it out. It's always active there. It's always fun. Everyone kind of sharing what they're up to in there. Other than that, you can find us next week. We still have you next week, Adam. I'm trying to remember that. So Adam's still here with us next week.
Yep.
Brian's still going to be out. And then there's a switch up after that where you're out and Brian is back.
Yep.
That's what I remember.
I'm not going to be around next week because I... Head out yes. On next Friday.
Yes. So, you're gonna be going to TGS, and then you're And are you gonna be staying in Japan just for a few days too, just to be there?
Yes. Basically, what happened is after last time, and I reported to my parents, it's like actually like the cost of like doing stuff in Japan is way cheaper than you think, because for whatever reason, like. People that generation have the mistaken impression that everything's more expensive in Japan when the reality is
it's very
the opposite.
Yeah,
everything's cheaper there.
So basically, my dad was like, okay, I actually want to go on a trip. And it's like, well, I want to do TGS again. If you want to do a trip, I mean, shit.
So hell yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's a family.
Yeah, TGS is just a small part of my overall trip. And
cool.
That's also, awesome. After last year, I'm only doing the business days because I'm just going to be real. If you, podcast listener, ever has any interest in doing TGS, don't, unless you're a part of the industry, because the public days, no. Not only no, hell no.
Yeah, that's it's like going to Anime Expo when you're not in the industry.
I would not do Anime Expo if I didn't have... the press credentials that basically made it so that I didn't have to wait like an hour and a half in advance to get into a panel.
I don't know how people do it. I still don't know how people do it. Like, it's great that people do it, but also I just don't know how people do it. So
it's just not because you don't have time to enjoy everything else if you're interested in seeing any panels.
Like you're like, I feel like you're going to Anime Expo just like meet up with like a group of friends or
probably. Yeah.
people there, community aspect. Like, that's the biggest appeal of it. But yeah. Are you still here with us next week, James?
No.
Or no? Okay, so you're heading out on the 20th. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. So we wish you the best of luck and have a safe trip, James. Enjoy your trip in Japan and Tokyo Game Show. Awesome there. And until then, you guys can hear from whoever remains next week here. Until then, catch us on rpgsite.net and so forth. Thank you for listening to the TetraCast. Bye-bye. Take care. Stay safe. Have fun. Goodbye.